Since the end of the Second World War, international institutions have served as an important tool to safeguard human rights and civic space around the world, above all, for those citizens whose rights are not respected by their own leaders at home. Now, there have always been challenges. Think about the Cold War. But in recent years, they've become increasingly critical arena of contestation between autocracies and democracies. Indeed, in the 1990s, a consensus emerged around the idea that welcoming countries like China and Russia in international institutions would create a process by which, in the words of Bob Zelek, they would become responsible stakeholders in the international system. A view that many are revisiting and revising as we observe the challenge of growing authoritarian influence. The United Nations, in particular, has found itself at the forefront of a struggle between those who seek to bolster human rights bodies and those who want to weaken them. Beijing, a leading actor in this regard, has deployed an extensive toolkit to influence UN human rights bodies and to advance new narratives that advance the Chinese Communist Party's world vision. I'm John Glenn, Senior Director of the International Forum for Democratic Studies at the National Endowment for Democracy. You're listening to Power 3.0, a podcast bridging the gap between ideas and practice on global challenges to democracy. We talk with civic activists, experts, and thinkers from around the world about critical challenges, such as defending against disinformation or fighting corruption and kleptocracy, as well as challenges on the horizon, like emerging technologies and their implications for democracy. I am so pleased to be joined today by Sophie Richardson, a visiting scholar at Stanford and former China director of Human Rights Watch, to discuss the importance of the global human rights system for civil society and consider how civil society can lead the charge to bolster international human rights institutions. Sophie is widely respected as one of the sharpest thinkers on China in town here. She previously worked as the China director at Human Rights Watch, a leading non-governmental organization committing to promoting and protecting human rights for over 15 years. She's testified at the Canadian Parliament, the European Parliament, and the United States Senate and House of Representatives, and written and published widely. Sophie, thanks for joining us today.
John, it's lovely to be home here at the NED.
Sophie, one of my favorite parts of these podcasts is the remarkable people we get to host here. People like yourself, who have incredible experience that guides their insights and the like. So before diving into the issues, could we just take a moment and ask you to share a little bit about how you got into this and tell us about yourself? I mean, what led you to focus on China and these authoritarian issues in the human rights system?
Well, as a personal matter, I think a formative experience was going to China for the first time when I was a college sophomore. And this was just months after the Tiananmen massacre.
Of course.
And the reason our university chose to go where it did was that we would be allowed to have Chinese roommates, which was quite unusual at the time. But when we arrived in late August, our peers were finishing classes from the previous semester because they'd been suspended and were having to spend time in additional political thought classes. And so day after day, we, you know, the 10 of us, from our hippie school, would
Sophie and I both went to Oberlin College.
True, would see our future friends literally over a wall in another building, hour after hour after hour in these classes, and it left.
Were you there in August of 1989?
Yeah, we got there in late August of 1989.
But July 4th is, of course, when the massacre happened.
June 4th. We were in Kunming.
2 months later.
And we had, you know, we had come from an environment in which we were all encouraged to question and argue and vote and organize. And there were people our age who were visibly having a very different experience.
Wow.
And it left an enormous impression. And when I got into working for human rights organizations, I think seeing particularly the ways that activists from China were blocked from certain kinds of institutions, in some cases literally thrown out of buildings, you know, were kept from participating in discussions that were more theirs to be a part of than some of the rest of us. And you know, I think when you grow up in a world where, you know, at least on paper, your rights are reasonably readily accessible to you, and you have these quite visceral experiences.
Wow.
Seeing the denials, it's a pretty powerful influence. Leaves an impression. More than an impression.
No, it makes a lot. Of course, it's a very powerful story. I hadn't realized you were there so closely afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, what, maybe even just one bit more? I mean, how, so an experience like that can lead you in a lot of different directions. What led you into thinking about sort of really the human rights work? Was it the experience of the students that you saw, or how did you end up getting there? I mean,
I think it had to do with, you know, being raised by people who cared a lot about civil rights and social justice here in the U.S. You know, and I think coming to realize the opportunities that are afforded to people who live in the kinds of environments that we do, and wanting very much to try to secure that for other people too. And, you know, it's been the privilege of a lifetime, John, to work with people across the community of human rights defenders from the mainland, from the Uyghur region, from Tibet, from Hong Kong, from Taiwan, you know, people who face enormous obstacles and pay a real price for doing the work they do.
What a foundation for that. Well, let's dive in.
Sure.
Let's dive in. So let's talk about the international human rights system. I mean, one of the things that always strikes me is when you pay attention to this is that it isn't clear that China is overtly seeking to abolish these international human rights organizations or overthrow them. Indeed, at times it presents itself as the defender of these institutions, but it is clearly trying to influence them. I think it's fair to say to rewrite the rules or the principles around which they operate. So let me start, if I can, by asking you. I recognize there's a debate about how we might understand China's intentions, but let's start by taking them at their word. Let's listen to them in their own terms. What did they say they want, especially perhaps under Xi since 2012?
Well, the Chinese government will say, and indeed Wang Yi, the foreign minister, just gave remarks at the high-level segment of the session of the UN Human Rights Council that just opened this week, to talk about human rights as a tool for development, as a matter of state sovereignty, as an essential part of global peace. You know, the tragedy, of course, is that they don't mean it, you know, and that their conception of these rights, and by they here, I want to be very clear that I'm talking about the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
You know, that the thinking is very much that rights are something for states to give and take away, which is very different from the way international law is written and understood. You know, rights belong to the individual. They are for an individual to exercise, not for a state to say, yes, you can have religious freedom, but not the right to vote. But let's also remember that the international human rights system exists because governments fail people. Governments abuse people.
Right.
Governments deny people access to justice. And so there has to be a supranational system to which people can appeal. You know, when on the rare occasions that I've had the chance to debate some of these ideas with Chinese government officials, you know, they will say that they are upholders of their treaty obligations, that there are not serious violations inside the country, to which I then say, well, why not sign on to, for example, the aspects of international human rights treaties that allow people inside your country to bring complaints to various parts of the UN? If you've got nothing to hide, why not participate fully? But I think the Chinese government's real agenda across this system really is to control particularly the debate about the Chinese government's human rights violations.
Right.
I think increasingly it's trying to remove the ability of the international human rights system to actually pursue accountability and to try to remove a role for independent civil society. I do want to make reference to our good friend, Professor Rana Seo Inboden's work on this topic. Nobody has written as she has, trying to unpack the details of the Chinese government's role across a couple of different key moments in the evolution of the human rights system to see what Beijing was actually trying to accomplish. And in none of the cases that she looks at can we say that the goal was clearly to try to mitigate human rights abuses or find solutions for the victims and survivors.
Well, obviously, this issue of accountability that you phrased to avoid is really key here. But maybe I can, you know, sort of let's dig a little step deeper. One of the interesting things here, not just because we're at the endowment, is the way the Chinese use the term democracy. Now, to be fair, there was a long tradition of democracy under the Cold War, and the Soviet states referred to themselves as people's democracies and the like. But I was so struck before the first U.S.-led summit for democracy a couple of years ago when the Russian and Chinese ambassadors to the United States felt compelled to release a joint op-ed in which they proclaimed that their countries were the true democracies. So what's going on here?
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, who doesn't like democracy? It sounds nice, right?
Right up there with peace and development.
Because here we are at the NED. But Xi Jinping started using this term whole process people's democracy in the fall of 2019. And it sort of followed a little bit of an evolution. We don't necessarily need to go into those details. But by that term, he and his political allies essentially mean a regime that should be judged on the basis of its ability to deliver for people, typically in terms of socioeconomic standards and standard of living, for example. They do not mean, you know, open electoral competitive democracy.
Right.
It sort of is not about the process of how you choose a government. It's certainly not about how you hold a government accountable. Mm-hmm. So in their own, you know, sort of closed bubble of thinking, it makes perfect sense. It has no relationship to democracy as it is more commonly understood. It certainly has no relationship to the kinds of rights to political participation that the treaties Chinese governments have signed up to guarantee people across that country. And generally, the term is used outside the country as a justification or sort of to distract attention away from deepening authoritarianism.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You wrote a piece recently. I mean, I want to ask you about some of these concepts, you know, mutually beneficial cooperation, sovereignty and the like. But when you say this, it makes me want to jump to say, you know, you wrote that what's important is not only for the respecting of the rights and the violations that are happening inside of China, but that these efforts at international institutions have repercussions beyond their borders. Tell me more. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, let's start with, for example, the effort to try to have a debate at the Human Rights Council about Chinese government violations targeting Uyghurs and others, which the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights had concluded a few months earlier may rise to the level of crimes against humanity. So some of the most serious crimes under international human rights law. And that effort, unfortunately, fell short only by two votes, which I actually take a certain amount of encouragement from, meaning that if we all went back to, you know, the battle, its potential, it's possible that it could be won. But I bring this up as an example because when one of the most powerful governments in the world, and indeed a P5 member state, can't be held accountable for violations of that scope and scale that have been so amply documented, I think it has ramifications for people worldwide. I mean, let's imagine you are tracking environmental degradation as the result of behavior by a Chinese state-owned enterprise someplace in Latin America.
Sure.
I'm coming up with a hypothetical here. Yep. And you want to try to hold that company to account or the part of the government to which the Chinese government that it's attached.
Yes.
You don't have any options locally inside your own country.
Right.
What's one of the logical places to try to go? To the UN human rights system. You know, but the Chinese government's power across that system is now so great that people in other parts of the world who are dealing with, you know, the fallout of Chinese government human rights violations also are denied, you know, avenues to redress this in some of the same ways that people inside China are.
You say their power. What's the source of that power? I mean, you mentioned them being P5 countries, but I mean, but it seems to me there's something else here. I mean, in some ways, it's almost a recognition that they couldn't do it alone.
Well, I have a couple of different answers to that. You're familiar with the phrase, nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes.
Nature's got nothing on the Chinese Communist Party, particularly under Xi Jinping.
Okay.
The resources that the Chinese government has spent,
political,
financial, you name it, on trying to exert its interests across all of the different aspects of the UN human rights system. And let's be clear, it's a very Byzantine system.
Yep.
There's the part of it that is very much the purview of states. There are, you know, the systems of treaty bodies and special experts. There's the Office of the High Commissioner. So you're talking about a lot of different actors here. And I think democracies have a lot of trouble devoting comparable resources to protecting those spaces. You know, the Chinese government is willing to go to lengths to minimize criticism in reviews that I would be willing to bet, you know, 99% of people living in democracies when their own governments are undergoing those reviews have never even heard of.
Right, right.
You know, but Beijing takes very seriously the idea that institutions that are not wholly under its control could somehow have a bearing on how they proceed, whether they're investigated, how they're perceived.
How they're perceived, sure.
But there is also certainly an effort that's very clear to go out and recruit particularly other governments, civil society, religious institutions, right, to align with or support the Chinese government's views. And it's not necessarily to shut these institutions down.
Right.
It is rather to reshape them, I think, in ways that Beijing sees as being in its interests.
I think that's so important, actually. That's so interesting. Because, I mean, whenever, every now and then you'll encounter someone who will sort of say, like, oh, what really, what does it matter? I mean, you know, this sort of situation there. And when you look at the resources they're devoting, you realize it matters to them.
Yeah.
They see something really important there. And I think that piece is important, that we need to sort of keep first and foremost, even if it's about the accountability, but then you've written a lot about China's efforts to ensure how China is perceived in the world.
Yeah, I think they care enormously. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly because they want to demonstrate both to Xi himself and to a larger population that global support is on their side. And indeed, the Chinese government just went through its fourth universal periodic review. So
right,
this is the peer review process that takes place for all UN member states about every 4.5 years. And you know, there were actually some positive outcomes of that in not just the criticisms that were the human rights violations that were brought up by a variety of different governments, but it was great to hear, for example, a number of Latin American governments raise concerns, to hear Montenegro speak up about particular issues. But the Chinese government went away from that and proclaimed that, you know, the world was on its side and there really hadn't been that much criticism, and that it had been praised by governments from all regions and from, you know, all different constituencies. You know, you would like to think that maybe someday there will be a government in power in Beijing that actually looks at this process as an opportunity to get some good advice about how to fix certain kinds of problems. Mm. You know, there are some governments that, you know, that engage these institutions for that reason, in good faith.
Wow.
That's not Beijing's goal.
When you talk about how much they care, it sort of leads me to thinking about the response. I mean, now, much of this analysis, and I think rightly so, tends to focus on the role of governments and what I've seen you in some of your writing, you've called rights-respecting diplomats, because indeed they are members in these organizations. But you also really highlight that civil society is both a target and a key actor to challenge these efforts. And I mean, it can be tricky in a certain sense, because as you were just saying, this system can appear quite Byzantine, quite complicated, and maybe quite far away from people who are fighting for their rights on the ground. So where have you seen, in your experience, in your work, the way civil society can make a difference in defending rights at these institutions, in protecting these mechanisms, including on the challenge of combating these kinds of narratives that we're talking about?
Sure. I think some of my greatest awe is reserved for activists who are from the mainland and who still have family members there, who will walk out onto the floor of the UN Human Rights Council and tell their stories, tell their community's stories, to share facts about Chinese government human rights violations, knowing that by virtue of doing that, their family members are going to be harassed, knowing that they are potentially going to get harassed by Chinese government officials or their proxies at the council.
Yeah.
And that the council isn't going to do much about it.
Right.
You know, that takes spines of steel, of titanium.
And increasingly, they're vulnerable around the world.
Yeah. And look, the Chinese government has unsurprisingly worked very hard, particularly under Xi, to make sure, first and foremost, that independent civil society inside China has largely been silenced. Mm-hmm. There are amazing people who continue to do great work documenting violations and trying to share that information outside. But Xi Jinping has also sunk considerable effort into literally making sure that people can't actually get to different aspects of the UN human rights system, to leave the country, to engage with experts. Hmm. It's a problem serious enough. Sadly, it's not unique to the Chinese government.
Right.
That the UN now has what it calls a reprisals report every year that tracks government efforts to persecute people specifically for their efforts to engage the UN human rights system. And the Chinese government regularly tops the leaderboard there.
Okay, yes.
But it also works through other, you know, machinations, for example, the accreditation process.
Oh, right, right.
The Chinese government finds lots of other authoritarian or anti-civil society governments to keep keep independent groups from getting accredited, that gives them access to the UN system.
Participate, right.
But I think civil society has also done a great job sharing information, particularly with different treaty bodies.
Okay.
So these are the bodies that actually check whether governments are complying with their obligations on torture or women's rights or children's rights, for example. And especially in sharing information with the special procedures, who are the independent experts across the UN human rights system, mm-hmm. some of the working groups that can actually accept cases and engage with governments to find out about uh-huh. what's happened to, uh-huh. you know, particular individuals like Gao Zhisheng or Ilham Toti or Zhang Jian. So these are some of the ways that I think civil society has played a very important role, not just in providing the facts, but also in calling out the threats to the system as a whole, because mm-hmm. they're often the people who are themselves, you know, shut out of certain kinds of conversations.
Right.
They are literally denied accreditation. Mm. You know, they're harassed for trying to participate. So I think they've also served a very important function, almost as a canary in a coal mine.
Huh. Huh. Well, so you mentioned Rana Suenboden's report here, which indeed we published last year, Defending the Global Human Rights System from Authoritarian Assault, How Democracies Can Retake the Initiative. I'd be remiss not to say, ned.org, please check it out. It's a great report. But this report says that one of the most promising strategies to curtail authoritarian influence is to mobilize transnational civil society networks to drive a democratic agenda. It feels to me like there were elements in what you were just saying, but flesh it out for us. What would that look like?
Sure. Sadly, we live in a time where Chinese government violations have both a transnational component, meaning that, you know, state-driven efforts to, for example, silence particular kinds of critics,
uh-huh.
but also that certain kinds of Chinese state actors are responsible for abuses that can be seen around the world. I think particularly of abuses connected to state-owned enterprises
okay.
in environmental degradation,
sure.
in infrastructure development, free, prior, and informed consent, right? These are
the
issues.
Road initiative around the world.
Consequences for people all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, I think you've seen lots of different kinds of civil society groups now in very different parts of the world.
Yeah.
Write on this or advocate about it or raise concern about it. What would it take to actually make that kind of transnational coalition, mm-hmm. a real functional actor that could, you know, work together regularly, that could, you know, bring forward reports, that mm-hmm. could help hold the Chinese government accountable? Resources.
Mm-hmm.
Resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a much greater recognition now globally of the commonality of the violations and what the responses ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
It is literally about finding the time and the money for people to sit together, to compare notes that what's happening in one part of the world is the same as what's happening in another part of the world. I was actually in a meeting this morning, 2 hours ago, John, a couple of blocks from here.
Okay.
And we realized that a particular Chinese state-owned enterprise that Human Rights Watch had written about years ago, committing violations in one part of the world, a subsidiary of it is potentially one of the most problematic actors right now in the Uyghur region.
Oh, wow.
But it was totally by chance that we were able to connect those dots,
sure.
not because, you know, we can form an organization that has the resources to bring people together
yeah.
and have them advocate at institutions like the Human Rights Council.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that takes we've got to figure out, we as democracies have to figure out how to assemble and mobilize resources greater than what Xi Jinping has at his disposal
yeah.
to make this system work for people who are, you know, victims and survivors of Chinese government human rights violations inside and outside of China.
It's so interesting. I mean, resources is obviously one of the pieces to that. I can see that. But, you know, are there other, when you look around in that landscape, are there other obstacles, gaps, things that are getting in the way of that happening? And
sure.
what might those be?
Well, those are resurgent authoritarianism worldwide.
Exactly, right. So the pushback directly from itself.
Right. There is, I think, the shallowness of democracy's commitments to human rights.
Uh-huh.
At home, abroad, in China,
mm-hmm.
in institutions. I think there's the reality that, you know, people who live in democracies don't have to, for the most part, pay attention to these institutions.
Right.
They don't depend on them.
Right. In the same way that people whose rights are violated must.
And so I think, you know, if I were a politician running for office and trying to make the case that there should be more resources spent on this, you know, it's probably not a winner of of an issue in democracies. I think we can understand this, but I can see why it proves difficult. You know, there's also just the raging hypocrisy of democracies. You know, Gaza, Ukraine, you know, tick on down the list where democratic governments have said they're deeply concerned.
Not and living they stop up to their right values.
And yeah. they, or they're complicit.
Yeah.
They're complicit.
I mean, but it makes me think, come back, frankly, to the very start about, I mentioned the Bob Zelik quote about a responsible stakeholder. Sometimes it feels a little bit, it's like the assumptions that we're operating under which can blind us to what's really going on and what we're paying attention to. And to be fair, I think in recent years, you know, folks on all sides in the, of the United States spectrum have sort of recognized that that's not the case. Participation in international institutions is not going to lead them to be a responsible stakeholder. Bob Zelik would say it himself. But it sort of feels a little like we need to then be asking ourselves, well, then what has that assumption done to our thinking about this? And how should, if we recognize that needs to change, like what do we get wrong with it? And what are the implications for what we need to be doing differently?
I'm writing a great book that hopefully will answer these questions.
That sounds great. I look forward to it. Well, share with us some of the thoughts from that book.
In the meantime, you know, I think democracies are still roughly 10 years behind in their thinking. You know, that finally the light bulb has gone on to say, wait a minute. Xi Jinping is not embracing and ratifying the ICCPR and becoming a good global human rights citizen. I really hope we don't have to wait another 10 years before other powerful governments realize that, in fact, the causal arrow is running in the other direction.
That's right. That's right.
And that increasingly we're seeing the Chinese government commit human rights violations in democracies. And the level of awareness and understanding is, in my view, worryingly low, which also means that the responses are very far behind.
Yeah.
You know, with a few very narrow exceptions, I think there's very little understanding collectively, let alone a cogent policy response in any given democracy or between or across democracies about what these threats are, you know, to elections, to academic freedom, to the UN human rights system, and let alone how to try to, you know, push back against those violations. Without also committing more violations themselves.
No, indeed. It's gone as far as in some places as to be the very targeting of people's lives and other places around there, and sort of a recognition about what does that mean about how you engage with representatives of those governments on our own soil in a certain sense, and a change in understanding that how open societies in essence must deal with the challenge of closed societies coming and exploiting these spaces. Well, we've got only limited time here, but maybe so one last question. I mean, these are so many, we're ending up at a place that highlights just how pervasive this challenge. We've come from the UN human rights system, but understanding about the way these governments operate in open societies, the way that we look at the challenge and how it means sort of questioning some pretty basic assumptions about how the world actually operates and changing our behavior on the basis of that. So before your book is ready, is there anything that for our listeners you might say, you know, these are some really key things I'd recommend if you want to know more about it?
You mean what people should go read or watch?
Read or watch or listen to or?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, we've already talked about Rana's fantastic work.
Yep. Rana Sue Inboden.
Yes, correct. I would read work that's been done by fantastic civil society groups, including about what it's like to try to interact with the UN human rights system. You know, go read, you know, read reports written by the Uyghur Human Rights Project, by the Tibet Action Institute.
Yeah.
Watch some of the UN's China-focused initiatives online. You know, you can go watch how the UPR played out. I would strongly encourage people to read the August 2022 Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights report about Chinese government human rights violations in the Uyghur region, which I think was, given the incredible pressure the Chinese government put on that office not to publish that report, it is a very strong piece of reporting. It's based largely on Chinese government documents.
Wow.
And it's the one that comes to the conclusion that the authorities may be committing crimes against humanity. You know, but you could then look at the debate that followed about, you know, some of the documentation about the effort to try to turn that report into
right.
a debate at the UN
right.
and how that played out. You know, maybe last but not least, I would encourage people to look, especially in the coming month or two, a number of organizations will be publishing remembrances of a Chinese activist named Cao Shanli.
Thank you.
Who was detained at the airport in Beijing as she was trying to go to Geneva to learn more about UN human rights mechanisms. She was arbitrarily detained. She was held for months and denied adequate medical care and died just about 10 years ago. And so there will be a series of pieces commemorating her life and her work. The one other thing I would point to is the wonderful work that's been done by some of the special procedures, the UN experts within the human rights system.
Uh-huh.
on everything from Article 23 in Hong Kong all the way through to threats to mother tongue language education, to, you know, targeting Chinese human rights defenders. This group came together in the summer of 2020. I would have to check. It's terrible. I can't remember.
22 is pandemic.
Published an amazing statement really calling the Chinese government out on exactly where we started,
okay.
on whether it really was going to take seriously its obligations under international human rights law, cooperate with the UN human rights system, you know, and end certain kinds of abuses. It's a remarkable statement.
Sophie, thank you. I feel like each time when we have, I've had the chance to have this kind of conversation with you, there's a door at every end of the conversation that I want to open and go down and continue on it that way. But I feel like we've really, I think, laid out some really compelling ideas here with a lot of food for thought. So I want to really express my appreciation for you coming to join us.
Wonderful, wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's really great. So that concludes this episode of the Power 3.0 podcast. This is brought to you by the International Forum for Democratic Studies at the National Endowment for Democracy. Please, if you enjoyed today's conversation, leave us 5 stars and a comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast app you use. Clearly, for more of these issues, check out our companion blog, Power 3.0, Understanding Modern Authoritarian Influence, and additional resources on the NED website at www.ned.org/ideas. And join the conversation with us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, where you can find us at Think Democracy. Let me just end with a special thanks to our podcast production team at the International Forum, especially producer and soundcast engineer Amaris Rancy. Thank you, Amaris. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll tune again with us next time.